From bureaus worldwide, this is F. Hassan.
Thanks very much, Ali Barrett. Thank you. It is Monday, the 2nd of December 2019. It's freezing outside, but it's warmer here. Welcome to Monday's Richie Allen Show. Hope you've had a good weekend. Hope your Monday hasn't been too distressing for you, wherever you happen to be today. I've got a pretty packed program for you and a brilliant guest. Lots to talk about. Tweet me as usual. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Okay, let's do it.
Fabulous.
It's all good.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, the work done by Neil Saunders on Cambridge Analytica and how very, very wealthy conservative power brokers have attempted to influence elections in the United States and on this side of the pond is splendid. It's terrific. Neil has been doing a lot of work recently on, well, on what's happening around this general election. And I want to talk about that. Neil Saunders, mindcontrol.com, the qualified hypnotherapist, the filmmaker, the journalist, the author. Neil Saunders on this election, on the NHS privatisation, and much more. You don't want to miss him coming up a little bit later on in the programme. Before that, though, lots of fallout still from the terror. I hate to use the language they use. It's an alleged terrorist attack. Terrorist attack, not a terror attack, as they call it. A lot of fallout still. A lot of very interesting things to discuss around that. The COP25, climate change, Madrid. You might have heard Ollie Barrett on the news talking about that. We will get into that as well at this hour. And I've already told you that you can tweet the programme with your comments and I'll read them out as we go along. Ba-dum! Yeah, so there you are. Had to have a little sip of water there. Yes, Monday. Monday. Maybe I shouldn't have done the newspaper review thing this morning. I was a bit sleep-deprived. Well, in the extreme, really. Not my finest broadcast. I suppose everybody can have a stinker. If it's good enough for the world's greatest athletes to have an off day, I can have an off morning. Had a bit of an off morning, yeah. I don't want anybody to think that I'm unsympathetic when someone is murdered. My whole point is around the coverage of it, which drives me mad. It isn't just the coverage, it's everybody else's reactions. Reaction, seemingly. Their seeming reaction to it, which drives me mad as well. So, yeah, not my finest newspaper review, but I haven't deleted it. It's there on YouTube. Maybe there's one or two interesting points in there. Let's kick off with that then. Vigils for the victims of Friday's attack were held in London and in Cambridge. Jack Merritt and Saskia Jones were commemorated at these vigils, which included a minute's silence and attended by hundreds and hundreds of people who didn't know these people, which I find utterly bizarre. They were stabbed to death, we are told, by Usman Khan, a convicted terrorist, at a prisoner rehabilitation conference, of course, on Friday. That much you do know. The BBC said today, by the way, that Khan was given one of the lowest priorities for further investigation by MI5 when he left prison last year. So Mr. Merritt and Ms. Jones were both University of Cambridge graduates and they had been at this event for the university's Learning Together programme, which focuses on education within the criminal justice system. That's where they attacked the vigil then. Here's the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, speaking at the vigil.
We come together this morning as Londoners to remember, to honour and to mourn the innocent lives lost as a result of the horrific terrorist attack this Friday. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of Jack Merritt and Saskia Jones and all those injured or affected by the attack on Friday. The best way to defeat this hatred is not by turning on one another, but it's by focusing on the values that bind us, to take hope from the heroism of ordinary Londoners and our emergency services who ran towards danger, risking their lives to help people they didn't even know. And it's also by drawing inspiration from the lives of Jack and Saskia, who from an early age chose to dedicate themselves to helping others. So yes, we come together this morning in condolences, but also in a spirit of defiance, to say that London will never be cowed or intimidated by terrorism.
Cowed or intimidated?
By terrorism. And also to commit to honouring the memory of Saskia and Jack,
whom we didn't know,
by dedicating our future to one not defined by hatred, but one defined by hope, by unity, and by love.
Sadiq Khan this morning, but we've heard it all before, haven't we? Khan is reading from a script. Here is Sadiq Khan on London Bridge in 2017. This is 2017, same man.
All of us should pay tribute to the amazing work of the police and emergency services. The speed of their response led to fewer lives being lost than would otherwise be the case, but also the injuries suffered being less severe than would otherwise be the case. It is sad that officers have been injured very seriously in the attack on Saturday night. That's as a consequence of them running towards danger, encouraging others to flee and risking their lives in the process.
Script. It's a script.
Many, many people have been in touch to say, how can we remember those who've lost their lives?
Well, why don't you have a vigil?
Lives. How can we pay tribute to all the
have a vigil.
All those affected by the incident on Saturday? How can we show the world?
Show the world that London is resolute.
That we as a city won't be defeated by this terrorism.
We won't be defeated.
And so as a result, we'll be holding a vigil very near to this scene.
A vigil.
Down the road in Pottersfield Park at 6 p.m. tonight. We'll be remembering the victims, their families, saying thank you to the police.
I bet you if you asked Sadiq Khan now on December 2nd, 2019, could he name the victims of the London Bridge attack in 2017, I bet you £1 million he couldn't, anyway.
And emergency services, and demonstrating that London won't be cowed by...
Won't be cowed.
...by terrorism, nor will we allow these terrorists to fuel division and divide
our
communities.
Yeah, it's a script, it's a very tired script. It's not just him, it's any number of politicians, it's a script, right? Okay, so this Learning Together programme event that took place at Fishmongers Hall, London Bridge, that's where it all kicked off. The chief executive of Fishmongers Hall is a man called Toby Williamson. Commodore Toby Williamson, actually. Here he is speaking on BBC Radio 5 this morning. You're really not going to be able to believe your ears. You won't believe your ears when you hear this guy. This guy is the chief executive of Fishmongers Hall, where it all began. Here he is explaining to the BBC how it all went down. Toby Williamson, Commodore Toby, Fishmongers Hall.
It turns into a game of pinball bomb with added knives.
It what? What the fuck was that? Did he say there? This is the guy. Have a listen.
It turns into a game of pinball bomb with added knives.
It turns into a game of pinball bomb with added knives.
This is extraordinary things happening, done by ordinary people.
But this is a narration. This is like watching Jack and Ori.
Let me just bounce you round.
He's going to bounce us around now.
In reception.
In reception. So we start off in reception.
You've got Dawn and Gareth.
Dawn and Gareth.
One trying to keep that door closed against a vicious knifeman. The other calmly placing the emergency calls. Peter, Amma, they appear on scene, wrong time, wrong place, and make instant decisions as to who to protect and where to go.
What is this?
You get Alla and Sandra, normally dealing with coats and serving coffees.
Normally they take coats and they serve coffees.
And now facing a life moment. And then famously, you get Andy and Lucas starting a fight back.
Andy and Lucas start the fight back. At this stage, Usman Khan has got 6 or 7 people against him. Lucas.
They used fire extinguishers, they used chairs, they used these narwhal tusks ripped off the wall in the heat of the moment, and they took the game back to the Knifeman.
They took the game back to the Knifeman. This is Commodore Toby Williamson, chief exec of the place where this all went down. Have you ever heard anything like that in all your life? Well, it gets better, because about a half an hour later, he walked from BBC Radio 5, or just outside BBC Radio Studios, he walked to BBC One Breakfast Television. And it gets better. The same guy, Toby Williamson.
So this is a guy called Lucas. He's the guy who...
Wait till you hear the ballad of Lucas. If Johnny Cash was alive today, Johnny Cash would be taking down the details here. And he would write the ballad of Lucas, the Polish basement worker.
Glasses down.
Right? You listen to this, you have to hear this to believe it. This is on the BBC this morning, live on the BBC.
So this is a guy called Lucas.
Guy called Lucas.
He's the guy who cleans the glasses down in the basement.
He cleans the glasses down in the basement.
What he was doing when he hears this scream. The scream is so loud that as a first aider, he makes a choice. He goes towards the trouble. He gets there on the first floor of the building just behind me. And it's pretty clear that there's a bad guy. He's got two knives in his hand. There's blood, there's screaming, there's chaos. Lucas pulls off the wall this this long stick. He charges towards the bad guy, and he impacts him on the chest. And there's clearly something here that is protective, and it doesn't make any sort of impact. But he's buying time. He allows others to escape, to move to adjacent rooms.
Lucas takes him on with the stick or the tusk, and he's buying time. His assault on the attacker's chest has no impact on Usman Khan. But Lucas is buying a bit of time for everybody else to flee.
Rooms. At that point, he's got about a 1 minute one-on-one straight combat.
A 1 minute one-on-one straight combat between Lucas and the attacker. This is like a Sony PlayStation 4 game scenario here. So Lucas is now facing the attacker. Lucas, the basement glass washer.
This guy we now know by the name of Khan, he works his way up Lucas's pole, slashing with this knife.
He works his way up Lucas's pole. What the fuck is that? What did he just say there?
Lucas's pole.
Hang on.
He's got about a 1 minute one-on-one straight combat. This guy we now know by the name of Khan, he works his way up Lucas's pole.
He works his way up Lucas's pole. Now, Lucas happens to be Polish, right?
Slashing with this knife.
Slashing with the knife.
And takes he takes 5 wounds to his left side.
Lucas is wounded 5 times on the left-hand side of his body.
And he's going to lose some strength on that side.
He's going to lose some strength on that side, right?
But he's done what he needed to do in the first instance. So two other guys who are part of the charity, one's got a fire extinguisher now, and one's got this narwhal tusk ripped off the wall. They come and join the fight. And it's
guy with a fire extinguisher, guy with a tusk comes to join the fight. Lucas has been wounded 5 times on his left-hand side, and he's losing a bit of strength.
I think the terrorist decided he was outnumbered. He runs for it. He goes down the main staircase, and the next bit of hell is at reception. He can't get out the front door, so he turns to reception when our guy called Gareth, who's the doorman.
Gareth.
Doorman is pushing the door shut as good as he can, so that Dawn, a yard behind, can get on the telephones.
This is some story, isn't it? This is Toby Williamson, the Commodore, the man who runs Fishmongers Hall. What a tale this is.
Alarms, do exactly as her training is told to do. Khan shifts his position to the cloakroom, the girl's there.
He sounds like a horse racing commentator, doesn't he? Coming up on the outside, it's Khan there with Lucas coming in just behind him. Just about 4 furlongs up ahead, you've got Gareth with the fire extinguisher. Jesus Christ.
Allah and Sandra, they have a hell of a time. And then eventually it all comes to a great sort of showdown in the entrance hall. Lucas is back in this point, leading the charge. And Andy's the last guy I introduce here. He's arming.
Hang on a second, before we talk about Andy, Lucas is back, is he? Did he say Lucas is back?
You have a hell of a time, and then eventually it all comes to a great sort of showdown in the entrance hall. Lucas is back in this point.
Lucas is back. Go on, Lucas.
Leading the charge. And Andy's the last guy introduced.
Andy, who the fuck is Andy?
This guy introduced here, he's our maintenance man. I'll tell you what, two things. He's a Ministry of Defence ex-policeman, and he's also a pretty cool...
We'll come back to that in a minute, what he said about Andy.
But when the knife goes to his chest and, you know, kill or open the door is the choice. He pauses for a moment. He's reluctant to spill all this out onto the pavement when members of the public are going to be facing the same problem.
They've just gone over Beecher's Brook for the last time now. They're heading for the chair.
Same problems, but he makes exactly the right choice. The door's opened, out the terrorist falls, and the first one after him is Lucas, shouting...
Lucas is the first one after him, who's been wounded five times. He keeps coming in and out of the story, Lucas. It's unbelievable. They're at the elbow now. They're about 500 metres to the finish line.
At everyone to get out of the way, get back.
Lucas is like, get out of the way, get back!
But I tell you what, members of the public, they just don't do that nowadays. They do what they needed to do. They join in, the man with the fire extinguisher, the man with an armour truss, they're all in there.
They're all
Lucas
in there.
Lucas is losing strength on his left side.
Lucas is losing strength on his left side. It's to come to the last 500 metres of the race. Lucas now is... Blood is pissing out of Lucas's left-hand side. So he's weakening after being involved at four different times during this whole scenario. This is Lucas, the glass washer. Wow. What happens next? This is the end of it.
Left side at this point, but I tell you what, his job is done. The police are here, and I think you've seen the rest already on camera.
Lucas's job is done. Brilliant. Fantastic. Absolutely amazing stuff. Lucas sounds like a cross between Steven Seagal and Bruce Willis. Eh? The guns of the fucking Navarone, Lucas, who normally works in the basement cleaning glasses. He's just a glass washer. It's like under siege. Who are you, Lucas? I'm just a glass washer. But the Commodore believes that if he had Lucas's medals, he'd wear them to bed. What a hero. And what about the maintenance guy, Andy? Did you catch that?
And Andy's the last guy I introduced here. He's our maintenance man. I'll tell you what, two things. He's a Ministry of Defence ex-policeman, and he's also a pretty cool customer.
Holy Jesus, what was that?
And Andy's the last guy I introduced here. He's our maintenance man. I'll tell you what, two things. He's a Ministry of Defence ex-policeman, and he's also a pretty cool customer.
So the maintenance guy, Andy, is a military-grade ex-policeman. Ministry of Defence ex-policeman happens to be doing the maintenance there. Andy, can you fix that leak under the sink or just kick the fucking shit out of it? You know what I mean?
What kind of fuckery is this?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I've read, listened to, seen, been party to some of the tallest stories that have ever been told. But that takes the cake, that, right? Now, obviously, the BBC and everybody else wants to talk to Lucas. Right? I'd love to talk to Lucas. And the BBC... television presenter Dan Walker and Louise Minchin, they express a real desire to speak to Lucas. But according to the Commodore, well, it's not likely they'll be able to speak with Lucas.
Yeah, Lucas is bearing up. He's a pretty stoic sort of guy. And,
he's pretty fucking stoic. He sounds like Rambo, for fuck's sake. What the hell is this? Lucas is stoic. I want Lucas... At this stage, Lucas is going to be the personal bodyguard of Queen Elizabeth II. The man is an animal. He's more than stoic. Right, so... Can we speak with Lucas?
He's going to need a little bit of space right now. And, but tell you what, he told me just...
He's going to need a little bit of space there, BBC.
Just a few hours ago, he wants to be the first one back into work, and I'm somehow sure he will be.
He wants to be the first one back to work, despite being mortally wounded five times on his left-hand side and fighting off the attacker at four different opportunities.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Well, do you believe that? You do? Do you believe the Commodore? Have you ever heard anybody describe a scene like that? Like the Commodore? But Lucas is modest and he's quiet and he doesn't want to speak to anybody. Back to cleaning glasses in the basement for Lucas. But I suppose at some stage they're going to have to provide us with a Lucas of some sort, won't they? Or we might be inclined not to believe the Lucas story. I believe that Steven Spielberg has optioned the rights to Lucas's story. You know, Jason Statham is going to play him in some upcoming movie. It's going to be like Die Hard. Set on four or five different levels of the building. The terrorists just couldn't get the fuck away from Lucas, the Polish guy. Or maybe the reason they don't want Lucas to speak to the BBC is because Lucas is an illegal alien. Maybe, who knows? So what about this guy, Usman Khan, then? His solicitor, Vahajat Sharif, told the BBC that Khan was doing really well since leaving prison. This is the alleged terrorist. Vahajat Sharif, his solicitor, told the BBC, I'm really surprised. You know, he seemed to be doing so well after coming out of jail.
I can't explain it because during my dealings with him, while he was in custody, and I saw him in around November, October, before his release in December, he had rejected an extremist violent ideology and recognised that it had led him to spend 8 years of his young life in prison. So there was that acknowledgement even at that stage. So I don't know what happened after he served the custodial part of his sentence and was released on licence.
Yeah, it's a big mystery. Bewildering. Then the BBC Radio 5's Nicky Campbell, Scottish guy, speaks to a jihadi daddy, but a reformed jihadi daddy. Yes, but don't get too excited, because maybe Usman Khan is pretending. Maybe this guy's pretending. This is Manuel Ali, a former radical jihadist. He now works with the UK government and other governments to reform terrorists. What the hell, says Nicky Campbell? Did Usman Khan deceive us all, did he?
Do you suspect it was all a deception by him?
Faked compliance. I mean, it is very much possible.
Have you seen that before, fake compliance?
Yes, we have. Yes, I have, in some of my cases. We are given adequate training, I think, and we have to keep on honing our skills and not be too trusting. So the intervention providers, I mean, the Home Office does put across a range of courses, and one of them would be by a psychologist who would tell us about how to notice these things and not to be too gullible. But yeah, I mean, that is the main point. You know, if it appears a person like him appears to have given up, then on what basis is Rajahat, I don't know, I've forgotten his last name, how is he saying this? I mean, anybody can say, well, I'm a nice, peaceful person, no, I don't bear hatred and grudges, and I'm not going to do anything bad. But on what basis? Because these people were committed enough to go and try to commit terrorist outrages. And of course, this one went and committed murder. So, I mean, How did they, just because he said so? I mean, what were the kind of like points addressed over which period of time, and how was the interaction? I mean, there are so many things we can talk about. I mean, has he given up the idea that there is a goal to establish an Islamic state? Does he believe Israel should be completely destroyed so that it doesn't exist at all? So
what the fuck has Israel got to do with it?
Doesn't exist at all.
So you ask him, you say, do you believe that Israel should be completely destroyed so it doesn't exist at all? And he says, no, I've changed my opinion on that. I'm for a two-state solution. How do you know he's telling the truth?
Well, you don't. You can't guarantee that.
No guarantees.
I mean, everybody will be completely de-radicalized or will be made safe. And I mean, the rate of recidivism is quite low amongst these people. Some do manage to slip through because they have managed to deceive us.
Because they've managed to deceive us. There's only one thing for it. Get Dr. Silberman on the case. He knows when prisoners are lying through their teeth to secure early release.
Let's go back to what you were saying about those Terminator machines.
Yes.
Now you think they don't exist.
They don't exist.
She's lying.
I know that now.
But you've told me on many occasions about how you crushed one in a hydraulic press.
Well, if I had, there would have been some evidence. They would have found something at the factory.
I see. So you don't believe anymore that the company covered it up?
No. Why would they?
Yeah, he could just leave or go, but Silberman is not stupid.
Well, Sarah, here's the problem. I know how smart you are. And I think you're just telling me what I want to hear. I don't think you really believe what you're telling me today.
Yeah.
I think if I put you in minimum security, you'll just try to escape again. Not for a while. I don't see any choice but to recommend to the review board that you stay here for another 6 months.
Yeah, he's not falling for it. Get Silberman on the case. This is the Richie Allen Show, 28 minutes past the hour. Monday's programme's the 2nd of December 2019. Finally, for now, on the attack, because we've dedicated a lot of time to it. What a bizarre story. by Toby Williamson, eh? I'm seeing your tweets. I'm seeing your tweets. Finally, on the attack, Joe Cox, Labour MP, murdered back in June of 2016, just before the referendum. Her husband, Brendan Cox, was on Sky News today with Kay Burley. Very interesting. He's part of a new proposed survivors charter for politicians, the public and the media. Survivors of terrorism have drawn up a charter for me and you, the public, that's us, for politicians and the media. It is a blueprint on what we need to do for survivors of terror. Ah, sure, 'tis only mad shite to be sure, Brendan Cox.
Yeah, so, I mean, this has come together, dozens of survivors of different attacks going back years, who have all, I think, had a shared collective experience, who have gone through this and who want to make sure that we learn the right lessons from this, that it doesn't descend into some name-calling political fight where people are just trying to blame each other, but we actually learn the proper lessons. And for us, there are lessons for the public, for survivors, that public compassion and support, the sort of outpouring that you're seeing in response to what's happened to the death of Jack and Saskia, that really matters. It really changes people's experience. It really helps. I think often the public don't get that sense. It feels like, you know, that outpouring of collective grief doesn't go anywhere, but for survivors really wanted to tell people that it does. And then the flip of that is that those people who try to use those moments to score their own political points or to drive hatred against whole groups, again, all of the survivors we've been talking to find that repulsive. The second thing then is the media. So how do we talk about this? How do we make sure that the focus isn't on the individual who did this and that one act of evil? Because that's what they want. They want you to tell their story. They want you to give them profile. They're looking for that infamy. So how do we actually keep the focus on the heroes, as lots of people have been doing, on the survivors, as your correspondent was talking about, and again, those people that have been lost?
Brendan Cox there. Let's play that back again with the fat trimmed away from it. Let's hear Cox synopsise what the public and media should do after an attack to make the survivors feel a bit better.
For survivors, that public compassion and support, the sort of outpouring that you're seeing in response to what's happened to the death of Jack and Saskia, that really matters. It really changes people's experience. It really helps. I think often the public don't get that sense. It feels like, you know, that outpouring of collective grief doesn't go anywhere, but for survivors really wanted to tell people that it does. The second thing then is the media. So how do we talk about this? How do we make sure that the focus isn't on the individual who did this and that one act of evil? Because that's what they want. They want you to tell their story. They want you to give them profile. They're looking for that infamy. So how do we actually keep the focus on the heroes?
Very creepy individual, Brendan Cox. I can sum it up in three lines. He said, The nation should wallow in grief for people they never met. And we shouldn't ask any questions about the attacker or his motivation. Let's just focus on the heroes. That is very disturbing, that. A new survivor's charter. We love it when the public wallows in grief for people they don't know because, well, it helps the survivors. We don't want too much focus on the attacker, giving him the spotlight that he craved. Let's just focus on the heroes, says Brendan Cox. This is the Richie Allen Show. So it is. Here's Jamiroquai. When we come back, we'll talk about climate change. My name is Richie Allen. Welcome to Monday's programme. Nothing like it. Good to be with you. Back in 3 minutes. On my frequency. Ah, Jamiroquai, fantastic when he was here about 2 years ago at the arena. What a show that was. 25 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. My own website, triggerwarning.tv, multiple other platforms as well. Thanks for your tweets, lots of them. Let's move on. One person every 2 seconds is driven from their home by climate change, according to the Ginger Ninja at Sky News. Yes. One person every 2 seconds driven from their home. Isn't that right, Kay?
It is 20 to 9. You're watching Kay Burley at breakfast. One person every 2 seconds is forced from their home due to climate-fueled disaster. Oxfam's latest report, Forced From Home, found people are now seven times more likely to be driven from their homes by cyclones, floods and wildfires as they are by other forms of natural disaster. Tell us more. We're joined by the Oxfam Chief Executive, Dr. Danny Sriskandaraja. Thank you for joining us on the programme this morning. A person forced from their home every 2 seconds.
Yeah, every 2 seconds. It surprised me. Well done, Kate, for pronouncing the guy's name properly. It's Danny Sriskandaraja. See, I can't say it. Danny Sriskandaraja. He's the chief executive for Oxfam GB. That is Oxfam GB. He's not a scientist. He's not a climatologist. He's not a meteorologist. He's not a geologist. He doesn't have an ology. He has no ologies. He's the chief executive of Oxfam. And he's here to tell us that every 2 seconds, somebody has to leave their home because of climate change.
I mean, these numbers are shocking and they bring to life the fact that climate change is happening now and it's affecting some of the most, the poorest and most vulnerable people who had the least to do to causing climate change are already being affected. 200 million people over the course of the last 10 years being displaced by climate-induced emergencies and disasters.
Yeah, at this stage, her next question should be... How do you know that, Danny Sriskandaraja, or whatever your name is? How do you know that? 200 million, where exactly? Where in the world? And how do you know that climate change? But of course, Kay doesn't ask that.
And these are people, I'm guessing, who are least to blame for climate change.
He just said that, Kay. He said it's the poorest and most vulnerable people that we must be protecting. You know? He said that. Don't challenge them.
To change, and yet they're suffering the most.
Don't challenge them.
I mean, some of the stories we've been encountering...
Stories.
...in places like Somalia or...
I was going to ask you, how does it manifest itself? What are we looking at?
Nobody's ever been to Somalia. You can say anything you want about Somalia. You know? I know some people have been there. You can say what you want. Who's going to contradict you? Yeah, in Somalia, they're being driven from their homes by the climate change. Yeah.
So we're talking about drought caused by...
Drought in Somalia. What? Drought in Somalia.
Years and years of the so-called El Nino effect in Central America that mean that harvests just aren't as fruitful as they used to be. And so people are being displaced. They're forced to go elsewhere to seek work. The communities that they live in at the moment just aren't sustainable. Or it's in places like Somalia.
You mentioned Somalia already.
In East Africa, where another drought is leading to the destruction of the livelihoods of pastoralists. And again, forcing those communities to resort to moving elsewhere to seek a better livelihood.
Yeah. Africa gets fairly hot sometimes, you know. Africa is known to get boiling hot sometimes. In fact, Africa has been boiling hot for millennia. Drought is a regular problem in Africa. Lack of water, lack of rainfall. You know, drought that predates the Industrial Revolution. But this guy's not a scientist, he's a fucking charity manager. Right? He's a charity manager. Dr. Danny Sriskandaraja. And Bertie doesn't say a thing. She doesn't even ask him about raping children in Haiti. Now, Danny Sriskandaraja didn't rape anybody. But some of the people employed by Oxfam did. In fact, lots of people employed by Oxfam went to disaster zones and raped children. Kay could have asked him, well, before you go gallivanting off to Somalia to save the poor and most... well, least fortunate people from climate change, are you going to vet the fucking paedophiles who might be going out there, Dr. Mr. Sriskandaraja? But she doesn't, of course. Right? She should do. She should do that. That's a very, very big story, that. Aid workers taking advantage of people in disaster zones. Oxfam with their fingerprints all over that. Off to Somalia, are you? You making sure you're not sending any pedos out there, Danny? But she doesn't do any of that, Kay. She just nods along. Because Sky, like the BBC, is now telling people the science is settled. So now it doesn't matter who tells you. It doesn't matter who tells you. Mickey O'Shea from the London Travellers Association can get up in the morning, have a shave, leave his caravan, get into his high-ace van, and get onto Sky News if he fucking tells you that the travellers are being driven around the country by climate change. That's how bad it's getting. Doesn't matter. How's the high ace there, Mickey? That's lovely. What's happening? Well, climate change is happening. Madness. This week, conference, the conference of the parties, the COP25, the conference of the parties is in Madrid. World leaders are competing with one another to tell us the most horrific stories about climate disaster. This week, the UN Secretary General Gutierrez says we're all going to die. Past the point of no return. And what's really interesting is, and this is really interesting now, prick your ears up. This is where we arm ourselves with a little bit of interesting knowledge. NATO is meeting in the UK this week, right? NATO, you know that. Donald Trump is here. NATO, that's the military alliance, of course, between North American and 29 European countries. And they're not just talking about Russia or Syria or Iran. No, they're warning of climate change too. Here's Italian ambassador to the UK, Raphael Trombetta, talking about NATO challenges. You can't believe this.
We do have challenges, new challenges. I'm thinking about terrorism, I'm thinking about cybersecurity. Even climate change will be an important issue that even NATO will have to deal with.
What was that?
Even climate change will be an important issue that even NATO will have to deal
again?
With. Security, even climate change
climate
will
change.
Be an important issue that even NATO will have to deal with.
And how will NATO deal with climate change exactly? Will it invade non-compliant countries? Will it bomb them? Well, the answer actually is not too far away from that. You might remember this. I covered this extensively a couple of years ago. The president of the Rockefeller Round Table Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, is a guy called Richard Haass, neocon Zionist, major player. This is a clip from about 2.5 years ago. He talks about World Order 2.0. This guy is a major player in terms of strategy for the elite, right? Climate change, non-compliance, NATO needs to be involved. Here's Richard Haass, 2.5 years ago.
We need to think about order very differently in the 21st century. And for the last few hundred years, order was premised on a very simple idea. Big idea, and an innovation when it came up in the 17th century. But it's the idea that this is a world of nation states, and that the organizing principle, the ordering principle, will be sovereignty. And essentially, states will not use force to change borders of other states, and states will respect the borders of others, not just physically, but they'll respect it in a larger sense. They won't be interfering. They'll essentially leave what happens within other states to that country alone.
Right and proper. It's the way it should be. States will leave other states alone and respect sovereignty. But that's no longer sufficient.
That's all good. It's still necessary, but it's no longer sufficient. That if you live in a world of globalization, to make a long story short, nothing stays local for long.
Check out Mark Windows, windowsontheworld.net. Nothing stays local very long.
If you have computer hackers on your territory, they can cause mischief or worse all over the world.
And if you don't deal with it, we'll come into your country and we'll deal with it.
If you have a poultry farm that has unsanitary conditions, certain types of diseases can break out, human transmission, it can cause a global pandemic.
And if you're not prepared to deal with it, well, we've got a group of people who will come into your country and, well, they'll take care of it for you.
If you're India and you decide that your economy forces you...
Listen up now, this is where it gets nice and interesting. If you're India...
And you decide that your economy forces you to generate a lot more electricity, and the easiest way to do it is through coal. This will have climate change consequences for everyone else in the world.
So therefore, if India continues to burn coal to fire its power stations, and we tell them you shouldn't do that because of climate change, and India refuses, well...
...world in addition to whatever environmental consequences it may have for you.
Yeah, yeah. So, therefore, then, what's the inevitable conclusion?
And my idea is that sovereign entities need to have the obligation to make sure that nothing is allowed to go on within their territorial limits that has adverse consequences for anybody else.
Who gets to tell them? Sovereign nations have an obligation to not allow things happen inside their country that might have consequences for people outside the country. This guy is a major player. Richard Haass, right? Talk about him a lot, although not lately.
Have the obligation to make sure that nothing is allowed to go on within their territorial limits that has adverse consequences for anybody else. In return, nothing will go on in anyone else's territorial limits that would have adverse consequences for us.
Yeah. And if the countries don't comply, how would this be achieved?
And what we want to do is set up these rules through consultations and negotiations. Here's what every sovereign entity, including the United States, is obligated to do. And we'd agree to the set of behaviors and rules or norms. And then we'd also agree, how do we incentivize countries to live up to it? How do we give them capacity if they lack it to live up to it? How do we penalize or deal with those who violate it? And I called...
How do we deal with those who violate it? How do we deal with them? Well, traditionally, you try and bomb them back to the Stone Age, Richard. Isn't that right? That's a very salient little bit of audio that I dived on 2.5 years ago when he gave a talk. Richard Haass, the president of the Round Table, Rockefeller-controlled Council on Foreign Relations. Every crazy Zionist neocon has been on the board of that organization for the last number of decades. And it exists really as a big machine, I can't find a better way to put it, as a big old bulldozer, that particular organization, pushing us towards a centralized world government. And he calls it World Order 2.0.
I call this World Order 2.0, but
World Order 2.0.
But I think this is an operating system for a world in which globalization, not just great power conflict, is the principal dynamic. It's not wrong, it's just no longer adequate.
No longer adequate for countries to be allowed to do what they would like to do in their own interests. He would have a point if he was talking about countries, you know, bombing their neighbours willy-nilly for no reason. Of course, the United States does that all the time. But he might have a point, but he's not talking about that. He's talking about India burning coal. By the way, the United Nations has declared today that no new coal-fired power stations should be built after next year, despite the fact that the world is sitting on something like 100 trillion, billion, million, gazillion, apalillion tons of coal. And CO2 is not warming the planet. We have gazillions of tons of coal. But they're saying post-2020, no new coal-fired power stations, please. In fact, they're not saying please, they're saying it can't happen. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it lovely? These lunatics making decisions in Washington, D.C., in Madrid, that come right through your front door in the next couple of years. World Order 2.0. When will Greta address this nonsensical gathering in Madrid, or will she? I'm not sure. I don't know. 11 minutes to the top of the hour. So it is. Thanks for all your tweets, by the way. I really appreciate them. David says, convenient way to keep the rich Western countries rich and stop poor countries from developing industries to compete, says David. Faisal tweets, did Richard Haass, or Richard Ass, did he just threaten to invade India? That was 2.5 years ago, Faisal. Not quite, but he wasn't far away from it. You know, you won't burn coal if we tell you not to. And if you keep doing it, well, we might just get a coalition of the willing together and come and stop you. Imagine. Faisal also mentioned, perhaps NATO will discuss the carbon footprint of all the wars and bombing campaigns. Yes. John Parsons loves his high-ace van. Them travelling folk know their vans. Of course they do. Never break down the high-aces. Quality. My Uncle Jer used to have one. I was kind of ashamed to be seen in it. in my early teens, because at that time, the most likely drivers of high aces were members of the travelling community. And you didn't want anybody to think that you were a member of the travelling community. Madness. Hi to William in Scotland. How you doing, William? Steve says, Brendan Cox, hope not hate, a well-spoken dodgy fecker indeed. I think he needs to address Parliament and the mainstream media itself on promoting hate. But not much hope there, I state, says Steve. You're better than Stormzy too, Steve. And you're better than Grimesy as well. Hi to Lorraine Tullett, hi to Charlie Girl, hi to Patricia who tweets, how you doing, Patricia? Just in case people had any doubt about who Khan was, this guy Toby Williamson had to refer to him as the terrorist multiple times. Yeah. That's right. Dean tweets, it is horse racing commentary from Toby Williamson. Epic, he says. Shergar coming up in the rear. MOD police maintenance. Rocket scientist, glass washer, and a pizza-eating turtle. Wow, says Dean. It is some story. I do ask you to grab that little bit of the monologue and play it to the unbelievers. Nothing wrong with being an unbeliever. But to those of your friends and family who think you're crazy, let them listen to that bit of the monologue broken down by yours truly and challenge them to tell you that they believe that horse shit story told by the Commodore, Toby Williamson, and Lucas, Die Hard 6, the glass washer. Some story. 8 minutes it is. Well, it's 7.5 minutes to the top of the hour. Neil Saunders joins me in a few minutes' time. You don't want to miss him. Ian McKee tells me, Richie, next year's COP25 is being held in the smart city of Glasgow. Cheers, mate. Appreciate that. Thank you. Keep those tweets coming in. It's at Richie Allen Show. And you can engage with others on Twitter by going to twitter.com where it says search Twitter. Just put Richie Allen Show, all one word. That's all you got to do. And if you press enter, you'll see what other people are tweeting me. Hi to Paul Curtis Tours. How you doing, Paul? And thanks so much for the meme. I've just put it out there for you. Lovely. Jean-Ann, to answer your question, no. No, Richard Haas is a relatively young man. He's not that young. But he's not that old either, is the answer. By the way, for all of this Agenda 2020, Agenda 2030, and how tackling climate change is basically happening at local level through your local authorities, I can't recommend highly enough that you do check out windowsontheworld.net and Mark Windows. He really is a top man. All right, I'll be back with you in about 60 seconds.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
It is 5 minutes to the top of the hour. Don't forget, Neil Saunders joins us in a minute, in a few minutes, and it's going to be fascinating. You don't want to miss that. We've heard from another witness from Fishmonger's Hall, which is where the stabbing attack began. He's an American academic. His name is Brion Bain. That's B-R-Y-O-N-N. So it could be Brion Bain. Brion or Brion Bain. And he told the BBC that the victim, Jack Merritt, was the first person to confront Usman Khan. I saw things I will never unsee, said this American academic, Brian Bain, talking to the BBC a very short time ago. Here he is.
We heard shouts from lower in the building, and two guys immediately ran to figure out what's going on. Everyone stayed hoping that things would be settled, whatever dispute had happened would be settled. And the shouting only increased and increased and got louder and louder. That's when I ran down and saw the scene unfolding there. And you know, I was able to see the attacker. I was able to see, you know, I saw people die. You know, I saw things that I'm never gonna be able to unsee. And I think that,
hang on a second, two people died, right? As far as I remember.
It's when I ran down and saw the scene unfolding there. And, you know, I was able to see the attacker. I was able to see, you know, I saw people die. You know, I saw things that I'm never going to be able to unsee. And I think that, I think I want to make sure that as much as possible that we uphold the heroes of the day.
What? What's he talking about?
I think I want to make sure that as much as possible that we uphold the heroes of the day who were formerly incarcerated people, some of the folks who were often the easiest to dehumanize, to marginalize, to forget about. You know, they stepped up.
They stepped up. He goes on to say that he met Jack Merritt. He actually met the guy. Here he is. Jack Merritt, who
he
died.
He was brave in his own regard. He was the first line of defense. He was the first person to confront him at the door.
This is Jack Merritt.
Yeah, yeah. And so I want to honor him. I want to honor his father's wishes, which have been explicit, to not have his life be used for political purposes, to ramp up any kind of draconian policies, right? Because that's not what he was about. He was doing the work in the prisons like we all are, and he was, you know, doing the work for the underdog and fighting for people who've been marginalized to give the opportunity for folks to pursue their education.
That guy is Brian Bain. He's an American academic. He was there on Friday, and that was his description of what went on inside Fishmonger's Hall. Yeah. We're coming up for a minute and a half to the top of the hour. Loads of comments on this, a lot of interest in it. You know, I'm not making a definitive judgment on what happened. As far as I'm concerned, as far as I can tell, two people have been stabbed to death. You know, and I don't doubt that. And I don't doubt that Usman Khan was shot dead on London Bridge. But I can't take at face value the narrative that has been spun by the UK media and by people like Toby Williamson, the Commodore. I just cannot take it at face value. Not when you do a bit of digging into the man, Usman Khan, and his rehab and his solicitor. The fact that he'd attended some of these events, these learning together events before, that he was fated, right? Heralded as a great example of how you can de-radicalise people and how they can play a big role, you know, in de-radicalising others. And he went there to this event on Friday, Fishmonger's Hall, all was hunky-dory. Then he flipped, taped a couple of knives to his hands, a fake suicide belt even, and off he went. Maybe I could have lived with it as a narrative if Toby Williamson had stayed off UK television today and not spun that utterly ridiculous story that we heard him spin in the early part of this programme. This is your Richie Allen Show. Let's briefly get the headlines from FSN. If we can, I don't know if we can. Can we? Can we? We might not be able to for a minute. We'll get the headlines from FSN. When we do that, we'll be joined by Neil Sanders. What an amazing guy he is. Check out Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com, if you haven't come across Neil's work before. His evaluation, the articles that he wrote about the conservative effort That's global conservative financiers and their efforts to, well, to interfere in elections around the world, the financing of it, the companies they used, Facebook and all the rest of it. His work on that is absolutely unimpeachable. It's brilliant. So we'll talk about this election. We'll talk about NHS privatisation and the United States and all the rest of it. But before we go any further, like I said, let's get the headlines from FSN. Alrighty, this is your Richie Allen Show. It is Monday, December 2nd. The time, 1.5 minutes exactly, past 6 o'clock.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. 2 weeks of climate talks are underway in Madrid with a warning from the UN Secretary General the point of no return is fast approaching. US President Donald Trump arrives in London later for 2 days of meetings with NATO leaders. 19 people have been killed in a bus crash in the Far East region of Russia. And Germany's coalition government is on shaky ground after its junior partner party elected leaders who say they are prepared to walk away from the alliance.
Cheers, Ollie. Thanks for that. Before we talk to Neil, hi to David, who says, "We know it stinks, let it entertain the muggles." He's referring, of course, to the narrative around Friday's attack. Hi to Base Ninja, hi to Kevin Barwise. Thanks for your tweets. A number of you are suggesting some of the people we hear are actors. Look, I'm not playing the devil's advocate, I don't know that. What an enormous risk that is to take. You know, hiring actors to go on television to speak about these things. That's the reason I'm not entirely convinced that actors are used. Maybe it's easy enough to convince people that they saw or heard something without resorting to hiring actors, but I'm not telling you you're wrong, because I don't know. It's just a risky manoeuvre, that, isn't it? It's just a risky manoeuvre. Okay, back in 60 seconds.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Right, I'll tell you what, let's make it 3 minutes. Let's take some music before we do get Neil on. Here's Eurythmics, music from Eurythmics, and a song called Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. Back with Neil Sanders. Right, Eurythmics and Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. It's 6 minutes past the hour, Monday's programme, busy old week ahead. Well, my guest this hour, top man, love having him on the programme, one of my favourite guests. He's a brilliant writer and author, a qualified hypnotherapist. He's got an MA in film studies, studied psychology as well. And you can read all about him at neilsandersmindcontrol.com. He's written several books. His book, Cambridge Analytica, The Data Deception and the Web of Popularism, is massively important. And I can't recommend it highly enough. And he talked us through a lot of his research around that book in the last year and a half on this particular programme. Okay, one of the biggest mind control programmes, one of the biggest social engineering programmes that we've ever witnessed. Data mining, emotional manipulation by the far right to impact upon elections and referenda, not just here in the UK, Europe, the United States of America as well, how the same groups work to promote coups in South America and elsewhere. I'm telling you, folks, it's Cambridge Analytica, The Data Deception and the Web of Popularism. Neil Sanders, go to neilsandersmindcontrol.com. I want to get into this election. I want to get into privatisation of the NHS, because this guy's got a clinical brain when it comes to analysing what politicians are saying and what they're doing online, what they're saying and what they're really doing. Let's welcome back to the programme an old friend of ours, Neil Sanders. Neil, thanks for taking the call, mate. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much for having me back on, and thank you for being so kind about my book.
The book is brilliant, mate. Well, thanks for sending it to me. You were good enough to send it to me. Well, I've been recommending it, and I will continue to recommend it wherever I go, because it's massive. Let me ask you this before we get into that. Brendan Cox, whom, if you didn't have a bit of sympathy for him, there'd be something wrong with you. His wife was murdered just before the Brexit referendum 3 years ago. But he was on Sky today and he was talking about a new survivors charter, how terrorism survivors kind of want to be treated. And he said they love, we love when the public kind of pours out this grief because it makes us feel better, he said. And then he said we'd rather that there wasn't really much focus on the attacker or the terrorist, because it gives them the it gives them, you know, the focus that maybe they wanted. We'd rather, he said, that they focused on the heroes. Now, I might be a lot of things, right, but I'm not a bastard. Two people were killed on Friday. Lunatics are out there. How'd they get here? Well, we could debate that, but things, terrible, bad things happen. But at the same time, when I hear the Mayor of London constantly talking up the heroes and the first responders and talking about how we'll never be defeated and London will never be cowed, you are the verifiable expert on mind control, my friend. Is there a little bit of mind control going on here?
Well, I mean, possibly, because, you know, it just sort of, I mean, to be quite honest, I do tend to agree with that. Don't talk about the perpetrator, because basically that's kind of the reason behind a lot of sort of shootings and sort of low level serial killers and, you know, wannabe type people, because essentially, you know, they've got nothing going for them and they want to destroy things and make a name for themselves, you know, live on through the ages, because everybody knows who killed John Lennon and who killed RFK. Do you know what I mean? And it's an easy way to do something without actually achieving anything. So I tend to agree with that. But there's always this thing, because it's the way that they talk about the thing. It's always to give that pervasive level of fear, basically. They're not going far enough in the sort of ignoring it, if you know what I mean. And obviously you can't completely ignore it, but the way that they talk about things is dependent on what they want to achieve. Even when they're trying to sort of calm people down, tends to basically just create an atmosphere of tension, basically.
Okay. Even though Sirhan, to my mind, was more than likely some sort of Manchurian candidate.
Bad example, because he didn't do it, but like, you know what I mean. Like,
I do, I'm not trying to catch you out. Listen, I love you. I love having you on, because we disagree and we argue. No, I'm not trying to be an arsehole here. I'm just saying that, you know, we hear from this guy Usman Khan's friends and family. Now, I know it doesn't necessarily amount to a hill of beans, but they say the guy was good and he was doing good things, and, you know, he'd been to a few of these events and he was heralded as an example of de-radicalisation. And
you meant with the perpetrator. I thought you meant in the statement that Sadiq Khan said. Sorry, I've misunderstood you there, man.
No, it's my fault, because I'm a moron sometimes, the way I phrase my question.
Well, it's entirely plausible. I mean, it's, you know, it's very weird, isn't it, that he came out of that, you know, the circumstances are certainly convenient, could you say. Do you know what I mean? And it often is these people who'd like just sort of flip. Like, do you know what I mean? The circumstances are just sort of, it's very movie-esque, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Like this guy who was released early and was supposedly de-radicalized, but then something happens and he flips out and it just does this just before an election. So it's entirely possible. It's difficult to say. I wouldn't really want to sort of, you know, hang my hat on.
No, of course, Neil. Of course, mate. I appreciate that. And that's the only reason I had a little bit of a disagreement with Brendan Cox in the monologue, because I understand what you're saying about, don't give these guys, this is the reason why they turn the cameras away when some idiot runs onto a football pitch.
Because
some of us, if we have enough drink in us, myself included, I might think of stripping down to my birthday suit and running across the football pitch, but I won't do it now because they're not going to show me. I totally get that. But I don't want to not focus on these guys, particularly when there are a few unanswered questions. I mean, know how bad the media is. The media just won't answer. That's all I was saying. Now, my friend.
That's a fair point, too, because basically, you know, there's ways and means. Just because basically you're not showing them on the news with like sirens blaring behind them and like, you know, hyping them up to be some sort of super monster, doesn't mean that you can't report on it. It's about sort of the way that you do it, basically. So it's to do it in a way that basically doesn't, you know, turn them into the martyr or the folk hero that they're intending to be. But you can certainly, yeah, you can say, that doesn't mean quell all, stop all investigation at all. No, I'm totally with you on that one.
Yeah, and you weren't saying that either. I wasn't suggesting you were. Neil Saunders, mindcontrol.com. Brilliant stuff. This, love having Neil on. Wish he'd come on a bit more, because you don't get too many more moderate and unbiased guys than Neil Saunders. Before we talk about the NHS and Matt Hancock, and again, great work on all of that. I mean, I was laughing when I heard the Conservative Party had the goal to change a Twitter account of theirs to make it look like a fact find an account. I laughed when I saw that they had the goal to change interviews, to edit interviews done by what's his face, Keir Starmer, the former the Shadow Attorney General. Is he? No, he's the Shadow Brexit Secretary, in fact. I thought Neil Sanders. And then, of course, when I saw that they were interfering with a BBC piece done by Laura Kunzberg, I thought Neil Sanders is just laughing his backside off. They're blatant with it, right?
They've been using bots as well. Boris Johnson got caught using, thousands and thousands of bot accounts, basically, to try and spread their message. And, they've already had a huge amount of micro-targeted adverts taken off of Facebook. If it's not, it won't be Cambridge Analytica anymore, because obviously Cambridge Analytica is disintegrated. But it'll be Emma Data or Firecrest or one of these new ones that is basically, it's exactly the same people doing exactly the same thing, which is, finding your data online, utilising it to make you angry, basically. So I'd be astonished if they weren't involved.
What if anything, this is all just personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at that. Now, I have no interest in any political party. I believe voting is a waste of time. A lot of my listeners don't agree with me. That's fair enough. But I have no interest in any of them. But still, when you see them getting caught out blatantly doing the stuff, changing the Twitter name, messing around with interviews, there needs to be some pretty strong punishment for that, doesn't there?
Well, the problem is that basically we've got to a point where there's no accountability or no outrage from the public anymore. I mean, something like the Jennifer Okori thing, where basically he's basically shagging this woman, right? And he's paid her over £100,000 to keep her mouth shut out of taxpayers' money. Basically they're spending £100 million on prepare for Brexit leaflets and just, blowing that down the swanny. All of these sorts of things, a few years ago, would have been political poison. But for some reason, we're in an era where, and I think it's basically to do with the way that information is shared and the way that social media utilises the people into moving people into sort of tribes, essentially, in political packs. There's very, very few people who will actually change their mind, regardless of what you actually show them, because essentially it's a war. And hey, sometimes it's all right in a culture war to lie a little, to that we all get our hands a bit dirty. So people do these incredible mental gymnastics to justify it, and there's lies on both sides. We're going to talk about the NHS. I mean, there's lies on both sides in regards to that, but one side is lying distinctly more than the other side, it would seem. But this is the thing. It's so people just ignore it and sort of pass it off. It's very, very strange. And it's started with this sort of, it's not dissimilar to what's happening on in America with Trump. I mean, Trump was possibly telling the truth when he says, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, I could get away with it. Yeah, people would forgive him for it because it's this whipped up cult of personality. And the reason I think that these cults of personality are so successful is because you feel directly involved in a way with where you wouldn't feel involved with politics necessarily before, unless you went down to the sort of office or stood there chatting with the bloke selling the socialist worker, or went to the institute and discussed sort of local policy or whatever. Now you can get online and have an argument about a football player kneeling, and all of a sudden, politics, I'm into politics. And the way, again, that it's sold, it's affecting you. Let's just take the Colin Kaepernick thing. This goddamn footballer, not respecting these people who fought and died for you. That's spitting in your face, that is. And it's it's not, though, is it, really? The thing about the Colin Kaepernick thing is, hang on, I thought one of the sort of facey things that you patriots were talking about was we need our guns in case the police turn tyrannical. It's before you start shooting at people, this bloke's kneeling to tell you that they're starting to turn tyrannical. Surely that's the most patriotic thing that you can do.
Yeah, and if there are genuine concerns amongst African Americans that things are getting worse for them, not better, isn't he entitled to express it? And say, I don't honour this particular anthem at this particular time. There was a time when I wouldn't stand up for the Irish national anthem.
Well,
so sickened was I by what was going on in my country, Neil.
Fair play. I wouldn't stand for it. It's sod it. It's pageantry that basically ties back to a classist and outright racist system, basically. The concept of a king, for Christ's sake. Anyway, but the point of the national anthem being played at American football games. The reason why there was the government was so opposed to any type of dissent of that is it was a Department of Defense and Military project. They actively encouraged and reintroduced the singing of the national anthem and the standing there for it during sports games as a way to encourage patriotism. But it used to be basically sort of in between the Gulf Wars just shortly after the Second Gulf War to get recruitment up. So they'd have recruitment booths and people stood outside handing out leaflets, and it's all to sort of whip up a sort of crazed jingoism. And that's exactly why they weren't allowing it to be criticised.
I sometimes, for my sins, I shouldn't be admitting this, but I sometimes watch my useless football team, Manchester United. I watch them sometimes on NBC Sports on the internet. I shouldn't do that. But at least they tell me. It comes up on the screen. You should not be watching this if you live outside of the US. But I watch it anyway. And I get the ads. And I've seen the ads, these crazy military ads, where you've got all these men standing on, presumably on the East Coast, all these men and women standing, overlooking the sea, talking about defending America's borders and all this madness. Nobody's attacking America. It's crazy stuff. Neil Sanders is our guest. Hey, listen, before we talk about the NHS, I love having you on because we can segue into different things. What you talked about there, the militarization of the sports to promote the sense of patriotism, isn't that also showing that binary choice tactic, which I think years ago, well, not years ago, but I think the first time we ever spoke, you and I spoke about this. This is kind of emerging in society. This idea that there's only a yes or a no, or you're with us or against us answer to everything. And that's not
precisely
true. Madness, yeah. Right?
And I think that you're absolutely right. And to say that that's permeating everything, basically, is permeating the way that people talk to each other on online. It's very rare to have just a pleasant disagreement online. It's oh, you're an idiot. And again, that's because everything's being personalized. You're getting everything fed to you on your phone, for Christ's sake, right? You are the media. You're getting it before the great people in newsrooms sometimes, because things are on social media and, someone's been shot or whatever and the video's been sent around. It personalises everything, but it personalises everything in a way that's completely unnatural. And to an extent, it's overwhelming as well. And so in order for people to sort of cope with this information, in order to sort of put it into usable blocks and be able to sort of get on with their lives, they simplify it. They massively oversimplify things, and they, confirmation bias sometimes, but basically they just permeate. They'll move towards things that support their worldview because it doesn't upset the apple cart, because you've got so many things going through your brain at any given time that a brand new concept like, hey, you do know that this is all bullshit and you've been lied to, that's incredibly taxing for most people at the minute because you've got so much going on.
Want to talk a bit later on before we wrap it up? Well, we've plenty of time before we do that. We're going to go to the top of the hour, but I want to talk about a programme that you're making with Jamie and Gareth Ike for a new platform called Iconic. I just became aware of that, so I'll ask you a little bit about that later on. You can give a plug and tell us where people can watch it, of course. That's what we're here for. 22 minutes past the hour. Neil Sanders is on, so it's neilsandersmindcontrol.com. Do check out his books, folks. We got to keep guys like him going. He's not going to be stocked in Waterhouse. Well, he will be. I'm sure you have been. But
I might be putting stocks in Waterhouse.
Yeah, he might put you in stocks. Yeah, fair enough. Now, the NHS, for listeners overseas in the US and other parts of the world, is something of great pride to British people. In Ireland, I obviously come from Ireland, we're very proud of our health service as well. Because, people who need healthcare get it, and it doesn't matter what they've got in their pocket, whether they've got a roof over their heads or not, free at the point of entry. It's one of the greatest, most civilised ideas of all time. It's very precious. Mm-hmm. And we've known, or we've believed, people like Neil and I have believed, Neil does more work on this than I do, he's the journalist here, I'm the presenter, but we've believed for a long time that the Conservative, let's be honest about it, it's the Conservative Party historically. Tony Blair did his bit as well. They want to open it up to privatisation, and eventually they want to sell it off piece by piece. It's reared its head more than ever in this election, I think, with the Labour Party claiming that Boris Johnson has already, well, people connected to him and the Conservative Party have already been talking to the United States of America about some post-Brexit trade deal, and that they're talking about giving access to massive healthcare companies in the United States to contracts maybe in the NHS and maybe more. The Conservative Party says it's a pack of lies. There's no evidence whatsoever. But Neil Sanders is fair, and he's a brilliant analyst when it comes to documents. You've been going through the pages of the documents that Jeremy Corbyn was waving around last week, and it seems that Corbyn might be right, Neil. Over to you.
Right, he's right and he's wrong. Just to be absolutely fair, I haven't found all of the pages, but I've found the salient points, and I've also found a lot of sort of supporting evidence, and I've found the American side of it, because essentially if you go on the ustrgov.site, all their sort of papers are on there, basically. So, right, let's just start with it. Do those papers, what are they? They're the sort of notes about the trade talks, the potential trade talks that's going to happen between America and the UK in the event of Brexit. And basically, this is the one thing that we've been sort of rooting for. Once we've sort of leave Europe, it'll be far more expensive to trade with Europe. The main sort of trading people that would be possibly China, but they're crap, Australia maybe, and America, obviously, this is the one that's being touted. We want to trade with America. We'll be far more better off once we've taken back control and we're trading with America. So this is basically what they're talking about. The first thing that's interesting is that basically it's very, very clear from the documentation that that America favours a hard Brexit. In fact, they're even sort of playing a bit hardball, suggesting that if we don't do a no deal Brexit, then perhaps we might not be doing the trade deal so favourably, or maybe not even at all. So America is really in a bit of a dominating state. Now, Trump has basically been sort of touting this in America and basically saying, look, you know, all these trade deals, we're going to smash people all over the world. You'll notice he's putting tariffs on sort of South American countries at the minute. He's having this trade war with China, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all about basically his prima facie policy, which is America first. Now, we're skipping ahead a little bit, but essentially what he's basically said is that in trade, other countries are paying far too little for American products, be that food or be that medicine or be that whatever it is, you know, soybeans in regards to China and that sort of thing. But the point is, Trump believes that they're paying far too low a price. Wilbur Ross, who is the United States Secretary of Commerce, has confirmed that any trade deal with America means that whoever has to do it, in this case the UK, would have to adopt US standards on food and safety. Right, so what? So when Matt Hancock the other day was basically being quizzed and he said, well, if the America goes hard on us, like, and says basically, well, if you can't have the NHS, you hypothetically, we'll just walk away from the deal. We will just, you know, walk away and we'll just say, well, we don't want to trade deal with you. The reason why that's laughable is because who else are we going to trade with? This is the thing that's been sold to everybody. There is literally nobody else to trade with. We've taken ourselves out of one trading block, basically so that we can do this particular deal. Now, that was stupid, because basically you've already put yourself on the back foot, and America's not known for being particularly kind in trade deals. But you can't walk away. So essentially, America has us over a barrel. Right, so let's get into these documents that Corbyn got out. Corbyn said that this proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the NHS is for sale. Does it prove that the NHS is for sale? No, it doesn't prove that. It does not prove that the NHS is for sale. Right, so that was a bit of a lie. It's a white lie, and we'll come on to it. But no, it does not prove that the NHS is for sale. In fact, the documents don't actually mention the NHS that often. It's very, very sparsely mentioned throughout the documents, particularly in the bits that I've seen. Why is this? Well, there is a thing. Basically, there is also throughout the entire documents the notion that the discussion of any aspect of the NHS is highly sensitive. And so the American participants very early on in the talks suggest not using the phrase NHS in any talks in order to not rile up the public. That in itself is incredibly, incredibly suspicious. So basically, what do these documents say? we might as well cut to the chase. Basically, what they want to do is they want to hike up drug prices. Now, this will be very, very beneficial for the USA, but it will basically put massive, massive amounts of undue stress on the current NHS system. And the concept is that they will slowly start to outsource and privatise the running of different aspects of the NHS. So they will gut it in everything except for name. So the concept is that basically they will not sell the NHS, but it's like slowly shaving a bit off a body. I'm not killing you. I'm not killing you. I'm not. Oh, you died. Oh, well, it's still a body. So here's the evidence that backs that up. And this comes from basically the UK and the US documents. It says that Trump seeks full market access. In fact, I've got the actual quote here. I sent it to you just earlier. Standards to ensure that the government regulatory reimbursement regimes are transparent, provide procedural fairness and non-discriminatory, and provide full market access for US products. And there's also another bit where they basically say that they want full access to our market as well. Now, that's not buying the NHS, but it does mean that basically, you know, they want access to everything. Now, what is it that they want access to? And again, I wanted to be completely sort of non-biased with this, so I didn't go to the actual, I've looked at the documents, but then I've gone to Chatham House. Chatham House is the RIIA, okay? It's a government organization. It's probably behind Tavistock. And so basically, if they're admitting to it, you can guarantee that, okay, this is the soft sell. This is the spin angle of it. What they're basically saying is that the USA basically refuses to negotiate or control prices. And this is one of the reasons that the USA drug prices are the highest in the world. And that is one aspect that they have said that they want to be involved in. It's going to cost the NHS. They want to do deals where the American drugs are used, and it essentially is going to cost the NHS a hell of a lot more. That will be passed on to taxpayers and essentially will bleed the NHS dry. Second concern is basically the US is trying to get what is called intellectual property rights that reflect a standard of protection similar to that found in USA law. And basically what this means is that they will have a patent over a drug, which means that other companies won't be able to produce generic, cheaper drugs, and that the NHS will be bound in this trade deal to buy those more expensive drugs. Wow. And the patent will last for years, if not decades, which means, again, a massive, massive profit for the US, a limitation on the drugs that we can buy, and a massive, massive detriment to the NHS. Basically, what all they also want to do is they want to provide fair and open conditions for services trade and other US negotiating objectives, which will oblige the UK to open up the NHS to American healthcare companies. So essentially what they'll do is they'll bring in elements of other things like, and this is already being done, right? In the last 5 years, £15 billion has been spent on privatization already.
Yeah.
And it's doing things like Virgin is taken over mental health care.
Yeah.
Carillion took over like the food and the cleaning, which went completely down the tubes, and then it went bust, and Carillion just liquidated with 580 million of taxpayers' money that you'll never get back, that the NHS has to recover. The other point, which is the final problem, is that they've stated that they want to dilute data privacy. What this means is that the US wants to have full access to the medical records of UK, of the people in the UK. It's completely against privacy laws like GDPR. And it's, why on earth would they want that? Well, I'll tell you exactly why they want that. It's basically so that they can target you with, like, let's just be very, very sort of non-hysterical advertising for certain new drugs that American companies are going to be privately selling and stuff like that at a very, very high level. It will basically say, oh, the reason that you've got arthritis is this political party or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, micro-targeting, yeah, to do that. So that is essentially what the documents say. Now, it gets a bit more complicated because it's connected with several think tanks. The most prominent ones are the IFT, the IEA, and the Adam Smith Institute. The IFT is the Institute for Free Trade. It's got people like Rees-Mogg and David Davis involved in it. The IEA has got people like Liam Fox, Michael Gove, Daniel Hannan, Boris Johnson. The IEA and the IFT are financed by the Heritage Foundation and the Koch brothers. This is not even sort of shy about this. The Adam Smith Institute is financed by the Cato Institute and the Claude Lamb Society, which are Koch brothers. Now, Which order to do this? When did this... Well, I'll just give you an idea, basically. Like, in 2018, at the official Foreign Office map room in the Parliament, the Institute for Free Trade held a launch meeting that was costing the taxpayer £6,000. This was arranged by members of the think tank, Daniel Hunan and Boris Johnson. The project that was announced at this particular meeting was a renewed effort to privatise the NHS. Johnson has said that this think tank was crucial for the UK's free trade future and was on a noble mission. And the IFTs have said it is connected to Koch Industries. The IEA, basically, is also Heritage Foundation Koch Industries. They've been making the case for the privatisation of the NHS for years. A good example is their 2012 opinion piece published by them, which was a long argument basically saying how would be the best way to abolish the NHS so that, private insurance firms can come in and take over the medical.
Let me jump in there, Neil. This is really important. So when these think tanks, like the ones you mentioned that Johnson and Daniel Hunan have been involved in, when they talk about privatizing it, do they explicitly project a future where people would have to pay to access services and to pay for their prescriptions?
Yeah, IEA publications make it clear that they want an insurance-based healthcare system in the UK and that they want this to be an open to private insurance firms. They want to see local health boards turned into competing national franchises, and they want hospitals to be paid exclusively by these franchises for the work done and for hospitals to be forced into bankruptcy rather than receive financial support and then have to be privately operated.
And that
this is
goes,
exactly what they want. And Health Secretary Matt Hancock received £32,000 from the IEA in 2018 for no apparent reason.
This is really important. We'll come to Hancock in a second. So you're ultimately looking at a situation like has existed in the United States since forever, that you might be in serious trouble. You might be on the street, you might be in the park, you might be somewhere. And if you could be in a desperate situation, an illness might have hit you very suddenly, and you won't get picked up if you don't have a carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of scenario they envisage for...
It's precisely the sort of scenario, and this has gone back to 1982.
You won't go to hospital, basically.
You know the last one, or the last... Sorry, excuse me. Well, it's talking about the Heritage Foundation and their mandate for leadership and the concept that basically all the industries throughout the UK, like telecoms and British Oil and British Steel and Rolls-Royce and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the British Airways, they were all privatised under the Thatcher government at the behest of this Reaganomics drive, wasn't it? Which was basically to create this special thing. Now, that was mandate for leadership, which was Heritage Foundation. Now, the only thing that basically wasn't privatised at the time was the National Health Service. Now, why was that? That was because Margaret Thatcher actually presented her cabinet with a plan. It was called the Central Policy Review Staff, and she said that she wanted to dismantle the welfare state, scrapping free universal healthcare and forcing people to take out private insurance and charging for education. Basically, she said, for the majority, this change would represent the abolition of the NHS. And the cabinet turned this down. It never got sort of into the public in a meaningful way because they knew that would just go across like, you know, that would be totally, totally political, like suicide.
Did she make any provision then for people that were unemployed?
No. Further to that, she tried again. She tried again. What she did was she drew up what was called the Omega Report. The Omega Report was drawn up by the Adam Smith Institute, which is exactly the same institute that is connected to all of this promotion right now.
They've been after it for years. For years they've been after the National Health Service.
Now, what did this do? The Omega Report argued that they charge for NHS services and replace them with insurance schemes, privately owned insurance schemes. This is, again, the same thing that has been tried by this particular group of right-wing think tanks since at least the 1980s. In 1983, that was when Thatcher, basically, she changed the way that the NHS was run by introducing the Griffiths Report. And what this did was, this was basically the introduction of unit general managers, which was appalling. Basically, now you've got where clinicians were making decisions based on medical experience. Now it was being run by general managers who were administrators. And this was basically when the downfall of the NHS started after the Griffiths Report.
And Tony Blair, of course.
Oh, Tony Blair, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the 90s, there was the Universal Care Act, but then Tony Blair started the sort of the overt move to sort of privatisation because he was using Bupa hospitals. Now, and I'm no fan of Tony Blair, and I appreciate this comes across as a right sort of bashing on the Tories, but, you know, these are the facts. There is a distinction between the way that Tony Blair used Bupa hospitals and the way after 2010 and then later after the Lansley Act was passed, how that ramped up and completely changed. Because, and I still didn't agree with this, but basically when the Blair government, what they do with, they would hire hospitals and move NHS staff into the hospitals and essentially just use their facilities. It was still NHS run, doing NHS procedures to NHS standards. Since about 2010, that has changed to the point where what they've done is they've outsourced services to the lowest bidder. And so rather than being run to NHS standards, they've just offered contracts. These contracts basically have been just appalling. And this is why you're getting such like appalling care from Virgin Health and Carillion and all these other people who are just terrible.
And isn't it true, by the way, this is really important. I had an amazing woman on the programme a few weeks ago called Finola Moss. She's a solicitor. And she's blown the whistle on the outsourcing, the privatisation of care for people with learning disabilities in this country. And she said to me several times, very smart woman, like yourself, she said, Richie, the one of the biggest misnomers, one of the biggest misunderstandings the public has is that the NHS is underfunded. It isn't, she said. And she explained why it isn't, and she basically agreed with you. She said that NHS trusts are effectively taking that money, massive amounts of money, and are using that money to pay private corporations, private companies, to provide care in so many different areas. You mentioned Virgin Care. She mentioned the companies that are running the care of people with learning disabilities. She was on to talk about how people with learning disabilities have been kidnapped, effectively. And knocked up because they're worth a fortune to the system and to the private companies that care for them. Maybe I didn't do a great job of explaining what exactly it was that she said, but she explained succinctly why funding is not a problem with the National Health. That's not to give a pass to the Conservative government at all, but it's not money, it's how that money is being used and where.
Yeah, totally. I would agree with that. It's not getting to the doctors and it's not getting to the hospitals. It's going to private. It's going to their mates, essentially. Yeah. And the galling thing about it is that basically what happens is, with Carillion, basically, I said about 500 million. It was 1.7 billion in contracts with two half-built hospitals. So what happens is they bring in, as you say, their mates. They do this contract. Now, the distinction is that basically, rather than, say, using a Bupa hospital and basically do to NHS standards, what they've done is they've outsourced the running of this service to a private entity. So they get the say of what is accepted standards. And the problem is that these companies are driven by profit rather than a duty of care.
Can I just say something that's really important here? Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com. This is massive, folks. He's forensically explaining to you how these parasites, how they come into countries, not just the UK. This has happened in other countries. And how they pick the bones off of everything that's good. Let me just mention something. Neil has mentioned several times there a company called Carillion. I'd done a bit of forensic analysis 2 or 3 years ago on this programme about Carillion. And here's a fact. I won't be sued for libel by anybody. Here's an established fact. I was able to do a bit of digging around. The former Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, who is now the editor of the Evening Standard, that bastard, I don't mind calling him that, he was rubber stamping contracts being given to Carillion when he knew the company had issued profit warnings to its shareholders, when he knew it was on its arse. And then, after he left his position as Chancellor of the Exchequer, we found out that he'd been doing some work for BlackRock Investment Company in America. And wait for it, the bastard, while he was giving money to Carillion, he was telling BlackRock to bet against the fucking company. He should be in prison for the rest of his life. George Osborne, I'm sorry for getting denied, Neil, but I can't believe the man's not in jail.
If you did it. Absolutely right. This is our point. It's crony capitalism.
Yeah.
And, And like, and it's appalling, and it's what's astonishing is how sort of wide ranging it is, and how much effort they put into it.
Yeah,
like, and it's just literally just, as you say, it's just asset stripping and just destroying everything that basically has been set up, like, to help the poor. And what's crazy in some of these things, as you say, is these very people that are going to be sort of affected by this that. For some reason, have been into a position where they're going to support Boris Johnson and they're going to vote for the Conservatives. And it's like, crikey, like, come on. Like, has anything been good in the last 9-10 years? Like, yeah. No. And there's a reason for this, basically. It's organised. I mean, it's the slow move to privatisation. This is the thing. So technically, when they say, no, we're not going to sell the NHS, they're not lying. Because they're not going to sell the NHS. But over the last 5 years, 15 billion, this is exactly what you were saying, £15 billion of NHS money that could have gone to hospitals, it could have gone to things, has been diverted and gone to private firms in order for them to run the services instead. And they're doing a crap job.
Of course they are.
And here's the other galling thing, right? Okay. The contracts are done in such a way, for example, Virgin Care, apparently, in November 2017, it settled out of court with the NHS. Basically, it was able to sue the NHS because its contracts were not renewed. Its contracts were not renewed because their care was substandard, completely substandard, right? And yet somehow they were able to sue the NHS for over £2 million of taxpayer money. And they got paid for the contracts, which they were crap at.
This is a sickening reality, this. Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com. We've got Neil for another 5 or 6 minutes. You got to understand this stuff, folks. This is how they do it. This is how they do it. He's described it forensically in his articles on Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com, and his books. This is how they do it. And the public are oblivious to it. Because all they get is a kind of a, Cliff's Note version of it on Sky News or the BBC. They get arguments between two or three different MPs about funding. Oh, we'll put more money in. We'll put more money in, when money is not the issue. By the way, if you want to find out more about BlackRock and George Osborne, just Google BlackRock, Osborne and Carillion and you'll find it. So Matt Hancock, then, the current health secretary, or the incumbent anyway, none of them. £32,000. Tell us about that.
Well, that's it, literally. Basically, he's in the pocket of the IEA. He received money from it and has spoke at the Institute several times. Yeah. Like, why he received this money, nobody's entirely sure. But, you know, he's the person that's basically saying, oh, no, the NHS isn't for sale, while it's cozying up with an institute that exists for only one reason, to privatise industry, particularly health industry, because they're connected to big pharma. Here's another interesting thing, because obviously, like, Trump makes a big deal out of being sort of against big pharma publicly because of, you know, this opioid crisis, stuff like that, although he's suspiciously lax on them in other ways. It's because he doesn't need to be publicly for them. He's taking their money via the Heritage Foundation. Like the Heritage Foundation, I forget the family, but they've gone out of my mind. The people behind not fentanyl, OxyContin guys.
Yeah.
They're Heritage Foundation. Like he's getting all this money from there. So basically, this is the thing. It's the behind the scenes, and that's what's so very, very galling about it, is you've got this public figures like Boris Johnson, oh, the Liberal rogue, blah, 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 blah. Oh, Nigel Farage, oh, I'm for Britain, rah 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 rah, and Donald Trump, and they're not. They're front men for massive, massive corporate think tanks.
Do you know who I hate more? Do you know who I hate more? I've often said to my listeners, don't hate anybody. Do you know who I hate? I hate the wretched fucking media. Because I fucking hate them. Because they know this. They could have destroyed Osborne. They could have destroyed Johnson. The reason why I asked you to repeat the thing, you must have thought I wasn't listening. I was listening. The reason I asked you to repeat about Hancock is because you talked earlier on about Johnson and Arcoori. This fucker probably has more children than you and I have had hot dinners.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I don't care. That doesn't make him any less of a man on its own. It proves that he's fundamentally fucking dishonest.
Yeah.
And the media won't touch it. They won't go near it.
No. There's lots of stuff that basically, it's ridiculous, as you say. Like, I mean, the BBC, like, Oh, sorry. Yeah, we accidentally didn't show him laying the wreath upside down.
Yeah.
Oh no, sorry. We accidentally didn't show him making a total tit of himself on Question Time or whatever it was. How many times do you have to see that before you go, all right, okay. I mean, that was the thing as well. Like, Robin, and I'll tell you where the connection is. It's a chap called Robin Gibb. Basically, during the Brexit the referendum, when it was found that Cambridge Analytica were being dodgy, what they were doing was they were specifically targeting far right sites like the EDL and National Action and various things like that, and also horrifically they were trying to drag people towards that with their micro targeting, suggesting towards the more sort of racist end of the pro Brexit argument. Now that's despicable. It's also desperately illegal. Now the BBC found out about this, but they were going to do a panorama program on it, and they didn't. They dropped the entire program basically because Robin Gibb, who is Robbie Gibb as he's known to his mates, is friends with Aaron Banks. And he dropped the entire story, just completely got rid of it. And then shortly after he resigned from the BBC, after he resigned from the BBC, Theresa May gave him a job with the government. And then the next thing that she did was she shut down any further investigation into Cambridge Analytica, Cambridge Analytica's financing, Cambridge Analytica's campaigning, or Aaron Banks.
Jesus.
It's like, wow, small world this, isn't it?
Small world, 11 minutes to the top of the hour. Before we run out of time, David on Twitter says, Richie, don't forget Joe Swinson, £10,000 bribe from the fracking company. Dreadful human being, yeah. Can't remember which independent media site it came from or whether it's true, as I can't find the link. It is true, but again, she's not being asked about it. Neil is our guest, neilsandersmindcontrol.com. Vital stuff, this. Park your ego at the door. Forget your political affiliations. What he's telling you is true. Whatever about Neil's own personal politics, what he's been telling you for the last 40 minutes is absolutely bang on the money. Two questions. The final one, I want to talk about this programme you're making with David and Jamie. But before that, what do you think about this particular election? How big an impact will social media meddling, do you think, have by the time we get to Thursday week, December 12th?
It's everywhere already. Like, that's the point. The problem is that social media meddling has become so ubiquitous to the point where people don't realise it's social media meddling. I was having this debate with somebody the other day. I don't believe any of your stuff, Neil. I've read the bit of your Cambridge Analytica stuff and it's crap. I couldn't be convinced. I couldn't be tricked. There's no way that I could be coerced into thinking something that I didn't already think. So I went on his page and he's got loads of Turning Point UK and Turning Point USA memes talking about how socialism is bad and this is bad and Trump is good and how the left is stupid and blah blah blah. Turning Point UK and Turning Point USA are financed specifically and uniquely and only by the Koch brothers. They're not even shy about it. Turning Point UK and Turning Point USA, so that's Charlie Kirk and Candice Owens and all the people that connected with it and have appeared on it, they're all a tool of Koch Industries. So if you're spreading Turning Point UK, you've been tricked into spreading Koch Industries propaganda. How were you tricked into that? Because they knew what pushed your buttons. They knew what made you angry, so they knew what would be effective marketing thing that you'd go, yeah, that resonates with me, I'm going to share it. How did they know to make you angry? Because they've been spying on you. They've been spying on you and stealing your data and testing out certain things to see what makes you angry. And then when they've got it right down to a degree, they just unleash it. An army of adverts and memes sock puppet accounts and bots. And it just creates this entire echo chamber that seems desperately important when you're online as well, basically.
Yeah,
for some reason.
And it drives you to Katie Hopkins and Tommy Robinson, of course, and all these fucktards. Of course it does. The far left has them as well. But people should go back and listen to conversations Neil and I had about this battle for hegemony between neocon lunatics in the West, the people behind this agenda, and the neoliberal madmen behind the European Union. We're in general agreement, Neil and I, on this. I'm not saying it's necessary for us to agree on it, but we understand what's going on. At least I think we do anyway. Hey, listen, before we run out of time, I know you're doing some work, not just you, but Richard as well, and some others, working with Jamie and Gareth Icke, whom I've got a lot of time for. If people want to find out what this is all about, they need to go to Iconic, that's IconIC.com. You're making a programme. This is exciting, my friend. What's it about?
It's about mind control. It's finished. It's out there. In fact, the first three episodes are up on Iconic. They're about sort of 45 minutes, perhaps a bit longer. It's a television program. It's about mind control. And because this is a subscription platform, what we've tried to do is try and do something with a little bit of production values, and a bit of entertainment values and stuff like that, the occasional gag, and that sort of thing. So. It's a program. Think sort of we're aiming for Tony Robinson. Like we didn't achieve that by any stretch of the imagination. But like you know, but it's better than Tommy Robinson. So it's in the middle, shall we say?
Somewhere between Tony and Tommy.
It's a program about mind control. It's the sort of thing that hopefully you might sort of see on Discovery Channel or whatever. But it tells you the truth. So it's me presenting facts and backed up by sort of stock footage and occasional sort of. Dalliances into different elements. It's kind of like each one's basically like a little documentary, basically.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen any yet. I will be watching it. Iconic, IconIC.com, NeilSandersMindControl.com. We probably won't talk before Christmas. It'll probably be in the new year. Thanks for coming on this year, mate, and giving us your time and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure, Richie.
Thanks, Neil. Merry Christmas to you and yours, mate, and we'll talk again the new year. Bye for now. The brilliant Neil Sanders, neilsandersmindcontrol.com. Get on it if you haven't before. Thanks for all the tweets that came in there, by the way. A lot of tweets on that. Yeah, that George Osborne thing, I remember, and I've never been one to kind of send it or sell it, When I sometimes get a bit annoyed, it's genuine. It's never contrived. I remember reading the stuff and I had to go looking for it. It even predates the Guardian newspaper story. In fact, when I talked about Osborne and Carillion and, say it for me, and BlackRock Investment, I was talking about it several weeks at least before the media here touched it. I'm not saying the media here got it for me at all, but I was onto that very early. Because I consume a lot of news and I've got a very good memory. It's one of those things, I don't have a lot going for me, but I have an amazing memory. I remember what I read. I remember it because I read it and it's just one of the things that was very helpful to me in my early days as a producer. And I remember when Carillion was going bust. I do remember at the time thinking, well, hang on a second, they issued profit warnings, didn't they? A year or so ago. Well, how did they get funding? I just started going down the yellow brick road, had a look into it, and realised that, well, basically, Osborne was involved, the former Chancellor, and that a company he was working for one day a week and was getting paid 65 grand for that work, by the way, extraordinarily, that they were betting against Carillion while the UK government was funding Carillion. Do you get it? You'd go to prison. You would. I'd go to prison. Our arses wouldn't touch the ground, let alone our feet. Right? These animals, like Osborne and Johnson, they commit grand larceny on a daily basis. And what do they get for it? They get fucking rewarded with cushy jobs, like the editorial seat at the Evening Standard. Not a summons from a magistrate. No grand juries, even though we don't have grand juries here. No interview under caution. No! No. But if it was you, though, and you worked for a company, and you worked in personnel, or you worked in accounts, and a few hundred pounds went missing, you'd be arrested before you could fucking say Bob's your uncle. That's it for Monday's programme. I'll be back with you tomorrow. I fixed my microphone issue. So the live newspaper review garbage on YouTube will be tomorrow at 9:30 as usual. Going to leave you with some Rod Stewart. Thanks so much to Neil Sanders for his efforts and for his company today. Thanks to you as well. Share that monologue about the attack and Toby Williamson, the Commodore and all that shite. See you tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening. It's bye from me. Look after yourselves and one another.